case is 2013-60002, Trout Point Lodge Limited et al. Versus Hanshoe. You may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Henry Laird with the Jones Walker firm in Gulfport, Mississippi. Represent the appellants, whom I will refer to collectively as Trout Point. I think this appeal boils down to three issues. The first is, does the court have personal jurisdiction over defendant Hanshoe? Secondly, did my client, appellant Trout Point, comply with the Congressionally Legislated Speech Act in its defamation action in Canada? And third, did my client prove falsity in the Canadian defamation proceeding? And I think since the third issue is really the linchpin of the district court's conclusion that summary judgment should be entered against the appellant and for the appellee, I would like to start there. The district court found that my clients did not prove falsity. Falsity is the first element of the Mississippi defamation claim. And that's the only element of the Mississippi defamation claim that is an issue. The record is replete, as we set forth in the briefs, of not only under oath testimony, but exhibits of falsity. There is an approximately 7 or 8 inch thick exhibit book full of internet publications, which we believe defamed appellant Trout Point.
Can you go back? You said there's under oath testimony. There was not testimony of the falsity before the default was entered, was there?
Yes, ma'am, there was.
Where is that in the record?
That is in the exhibits. And I may be mistaken, but the court in its 59-page decision in Nova Scotia referred to the testimony.
Are you talking about the default judge?
On the default judgment,
but that's
yes.
From the damages portion of the hearing. He had already entered the default. And
yes.
So there has to be evidence in the record to support the default before the default's entered, not as part of the damages hearing.
Your
and
Honor,
I don't know what evidence is in the record to support the default, which is the part about falsity, that's not part of the damages hearing.
Your Honor, the Northern District of Mississippi has addressed that issue in the Gamboa decision, which we cite in our brief. And there we believe the district court in another case correctly found that in a defamation case, like all other cases under Rule 55, under the Mississippi Rule of Civil Procedure 55, and under the Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 55, once the defendant, even in a defamation case, defaults, all allegations made in the complaint against him are taken as true and confessed. And the court specifically found that includes the allegation of falsity.
Okay,
right.
Well, you just said that the exhibits and under oath testimony support it. Now you're backing off and you're telling us that it's just the fact that he didn't contest the complaint.
No, Your Honor, with all due deference, I'm saying both. I'm saying my clients assumed burdens they didn't have to assume, and they proved falsity at the Nova Scotia hearing.
Which was a damages hearing, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, it is a damages hearing, but the court found falsity, and my clients testified at the default hearing about falsity.
All right, and you say you're saying, well, let's go back to the complaint. Did the complaint specify which statements were false?
Yes, it did, several, and I set those forth in the brief. Numerous allegations in what's called the First Amendment Statement of Claim under Canadian law, such as my clients were on the verge of bankruptcy, that they were involved in a pay-for-play corruption scheme with now-convicted Jefferson Parish City Council President, formerly Aaron Broussard, that they were perjurers in Canadian proceedings, that they were liars. And these are all set forth on the face of the First Amendment complaint. And they are found specifically in the Nova Scotia Court's opinion, which is part of the record.
All right, and you say, and it's interesting you say specifically in the opinion, because you'll agree with me, they're not found specifically in the complaint, are they?
Yes, they are, Your Honor.
Well, and I guess it's a matter of perspective, because it seems to me the complaint makes some very general statements about falsity, but Whether or not that's sufficient to put somebody on notice that I'm saying that you said this and that that is false, your position is the complaint is as specific as that?
Your Honor, the complaint is also backed up at the default hearing by 7 or 8 inches thick exhibits, which are the internet publications at issue themselves. The internet publications are part of that hearing. It's in the 2-volume set that's part of the record.
I understand that, but my concern is whether or not you say this is what you said, and I'm contending that this is false.
And because my client...
Does the complaint specify that?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. It alleges falsity, and it alleges, it's called the First Amendment Statement of Claim. My clients allege falsity. They allege specific internet publications that were false, and they're backed up by under oath testimony and the exhibits at the hearing.
And it doesn't say whether Trout Point was actually financially successful and whether or not it was on the brink of bankruptcy, did it? Does it? The First Amendment Statement of Claim doesn't say that.
I don't recall that it says that either way, Your Honor. It does allege that they were accused of being bankrupt, on the verge of bankruptcy.
Right. Well, then you have to say that that's not true and that they're actually successful or not on the verge of bankruptcy.
Your Honor, they did. And then there's exhibits in the record where my client's Ecotourism Lodge is an award-winning 5-star resort, and it was doing very well. And in the record, as found by the court in Nova Scotia, the judge there talks about the mental distress, the emotional distress issues my clients suffered because of issues like being accused of bankruptcy and how it was, they were afraid it was affecting their business.
Well, but bankruptcy itself is not defamation. It has to be false in the United States. So it can't just be the accused of bankruptcy. It has to be accused of bankruptcy and not actually on the verge of bankruptcy. Do you agree that many of the statements in the First Amendment Statement of Claim are opinion statements that would not be actionable, such as champagne taste on a beer budget?
I do, Your Honor.
That very few. So what statements are actionable? That's not really ever identified in the complaint or in your brief.
There are numerous examples of internet publications and testimony about those publications at the default hearing about my clients receiving money. They were money laundering. They were in a conspiracy with now-convicted former Jefferson Council president from Louisiana, Aaron Broussard. These are specific allegations and specific testimony. They are claimed to be lying under oath in Canadian proceedings, and they are committing perjury. These are specific charges, and they are addressed in the First Amendment Statement of Claim and in the hearing.
Let's talk about domestic due process principles. In order to determine if the Nova Scotia court had jurisdiction at the time that Trout Point filed suit, we can't look at the blog post that occurred after September 1st, 2011, can we? The court jumbles it all together, puts them all together, but really we have to stop at September 1st, 2011, don't we?
Your Honor, I would agree with you on the question of jurisdiction. I agree with that.
Okay.
But it is relevant to the inquiry of punitive damages under Mississippi law.
Well, then how is Nova Scotia the focal point of the issues before 2011? Because they seem to deal with Trout Point's connection to Mr. Broussard and the Times-Picayune.
Because, as we set forth in our brief, I believe footnote 10, I don't recall the number, Your Honor, we specifically allege that Defendant Hanshu recruited bloggers from Nova Scotia. He's bragging in his internet publications about establishing a new slabbed nation. Slab is his blog, slab.org. He is saying and being published in at least one or two news stories in Nova Scotia.
But that didn't happen until September 9th that any Nova Scotia people looked at Slabbed.
No, Your Honor. I beg to differ. In the affidavit of Charles Leary, which is referred to in the brief, he says that issue of...
Is the affidavit attached?
Yes.
And what does he say?
He says that the issue of Frank Magazine, where the interview by Mr. Hanshu was given, came out in mid-August, that the September date is when that issue is taken off the stands in Nova Scotia. So all this that I'm referring to is limited to prior to September 1, 2011.
And you're talking about Slabbed, though? I'm talking about the Slabbed blog. That was not on the stands in Nova Scotia at all. Nobody read that from Nova Scotia till September 9th. Isn't that true?
No, Your Honor. He was communicating with sources in Canada prior to September 1, 2011. He was interviewing former employees of my client Trout Point who were on the internet. And he is referred to in the affidavit of Charles Leary as having recruited former employees as sources, former employees of Trout Point. And this is an interactive website, I think under Revell and under Zippo, which the circuit has long since upheld. This, on the sliding scale, this is not a passive website. This is a very active, interactive website. This is as the publications attached as exhibits to the Nova Scotia hearing show, Mr. Handshoe is not only sending internet messages on his blog, he's receiving them as well. And he's bragging about his sources in Canada.
And you know how many readers he has on this blog?
I do not. Well, there's no way for us to know how many readers he has on the internet, Your Honor. I will say that under the Clemens case, this case on appeal falls squarely under Clemens. The focus is on Nova Scotia, Trout Point. The sources are there. That's the second prong of Clemens. We believe that the story is about Canada. It's about a Canadian.
So you disagree that the blog was primarily about the Gulf Coast, was directed to a Gulf Coast audience? You disagree with that?
On this story, I disagree, Your Honor, but even if I'm mistaken in that regard, I would say we can't look at just the blog itself. In Mississippi, one single publication can be defamatory. A publication which is pre-published.
Well, doesn't Carl DeVee Jones require that Nova Scotia be the focal point of the blog?
And it is the focal point of these internet publications about which we specifically complain through the blog slab.org. Slab.org comments on many things, but the focus on the publications at issue, the internet publications at issue, which are false, is Nova Scotia.
Not until after September 1st.
Your Honor, I think that the affidavit of Charles Leary referred to in the brief shows otherwise.
Okay.
I beg to differ, and that these employees were recruited, the sources were generated.
If the facts show that it wasn't until after September 1st that it was focused on Canada and that prior to that it was focused on the people in the Gulf Coast, would you agree that the Nova Scotia court did not have jurisdiction under Calder?
Your Honor, I cannot agree because slab.org, I believe, got its origin by reporting on slabbed homes after Hurricane Katrina. And that was the genesis of slab.org. It's gone since then, since 2005, far beyond. And as we set forth in our brief, since at least 2010, Mr. Handshoe, through his internet publications, has been defaming my clients continuously since 2010.
Well, defaming your clients is not the same thing as directing towards Canada. That's two different things.
Your Honor, he is directing it towards Canada.
Now he may be. But at the time, I asked if at the time he was not directing it to Canada, you can't win this case, can you?
Your Honor, but we did direct it to Canada, so I think we can. And if Your Honor would look at the footnote that refers to Mr. Leary's affidavit, I think you'll see specific instances of the internet publications concerning being published about things in Canada, including the Canada courts. Mr. Handshoe even went online and had to sign a contract and ordered information from a Canadian agency about which he was accusing my client of committing fraud with. These are in the affidavit referred to in our brief.
Okay.
So we think it's directed to Canada.
The court didn't issue formal findings of fact, did it?
Pardon?
It didn't issue any formal findings of fact.
I don't understand, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
The court in Nova Scotia didn't issue any findings of fact that there had been defamation.
Not formal findings of fact and conclusions of law. It was all together, Your Honor. The court did find facts, and it found that, among other things, my client proved two things that weren't required to be proved under Canadian law, and that is falsity and reckless disregard for the truth, and that goes to the Speech Act. Mr. Handshoe's case is arguing that he overlooks the language in that case. The first prong of the Speech Act requires the law of Canada to be at least as protective as the law of the United States under the First Amendment as it protects free speech rights as the law was applied in that case. Secondly, as I point out in the brief in the Gamboa decision, which is the federal district court looking at Mississippi law, and it's certainly able to do that.
But Canadian plaintiffs don't have to prove or even allege falsity in a defamation claim, do they?
We agree, Your Honor, but my point is that my clients did allege it and did prove it and did prove New York Times' reckless disregard for the truth, and the court found that. Right. Although it was not required to do that, it did that.
I'm sitting here with this 24-page complaint, and my temptation is to have you take me right to the good part, but I'm not going to ask you. I'm not going to ask you to do that.
Well, that would be very helpful when you get back up there, because it's not clear to me that you have any well-pleaded defamatory statements in your complaint that were found by the court. To me, at this point, it's not clear. I'm going to go back and read it two or three more times. Thank you.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Bobby Truitt, Jack Truitt, and I represent Doug Hanshew. The court is well aware that this is a Speech Act case, and interestingly, this may be the first circuit to address the Speech Act, which was enacted in 2010 by Congress. And Judge Elrod, you've hit on the exact reason why Congress enacted the Speech Act. It was to prevent foreign courts from engaging in making awards, substantial awards, for alleged libel where, A, they didn't have any jurisdiction, and, B, where the laws of those countries were dissimilar, vastly dissimilar, to those of the United States. And so that was the motivation for Congress to enact this law. It had its genesis in the Ben Mahfouz case out of New York, where a journalist wrote an article about a wealthy sheik who was allegedly financing terrorism. He got a large judgment in England against her, and that had its genesis. She then went to Congress and had basically single-handedly had the Speech Act enacted to protect people from having the right to say what they want to say within certain bounds. And those bounds are well-defined by the New York Times versus Sullivan case. That case has stood the test of time for what responsible journalists can say about other people and not be held responsible for libel or defamation. Now, in this case, it's clear that the Canadian court did not have jurisdiction over Mr. Hanshew. There was not even a prefatory finding that the court had jurisdiction. All they did was serve a complaint on Mr. Hanshew in Mississippi, and then presto chango, they had jurisdiction over Mr. Hanshew. But that doesn't comport with the due process notions that exist in this country. And Judge Graves, as you pointed out, there has to be some focus in Nova Scotia. Judge Elrod, you also hit on this. There has to be some focus of Mr. Hanshew's comments directed to Nova Scotia and to these plaintiffs in order for a Canadian court to have exercised jurisdiction. And that didn't exist in this case. In fact, if you go look at Slabbed, the title of it is Gulf Coast New Media. And as Mr. Laird points out, it started out as a blog about Katrina and some of the abuses that insurance companies perpetrated after Katrina on some of their insureds. That's what it had its genesis as, but it's morphed over time, and it has developed into a public concern blog that deals with issues on the Gulf Coast. Now, I don't know how you can morph that into being directed to Nova Scotia. In fact, the truth of the matter is the reason that these gentlemen were even mentioned was because of the fact that out of the Aaron Broussard indictment came evidence that Mr. Broussard had property that was next door to Trout Point and that there was management that these gentlemen were involved in with Mr. Broussard's property. Now, the plaintiffs alleged that the Times-Picayune said that Mr. Broussard had a connection with Trout Point or that he was a manager or owner with Trout Point and that was retracted. And that is true. But Mr. Hanshew never made those comments. So what you have is you have a Canadian court exercising jurisdiction over blog posts that are so tangential to Nova Scotia that there is simply not jurisdiction. Now, The court also has perceptively pointed out that in this case, there was never a finding that any of the comments that Mr. Hanshew ever made were false, ever. There was no hearing to that effect.
The judge did say in the damages hearing that he was applying a higher standard, or that he observed there was a higher standard. He said New York Times v. Sullivan, and he said that they were erroneous. He didn't say, at one point he used the word false, but he said, I find these things are erroneous. So there are some flavor to it. That's the best part of their case, that he did make some comments that he was saying that he had a heightened obligation.
Well, while that may be true, Judge, the flavor doesn't necessarily equate with constitutional protections that are afforded in the United States of America. And quite honestly, I read that same transcript, and I searched high and low for any finding, any prefatory finding that the statements that Mr. Hanshew had made were false, and I simply couldn't find them. I don't know that flavor rises to the level of constitutional protection that this court and other courts in this country have afforded to journalists such as Mr. Hanshew.
You were talking about reputed journalists and things. You're not here to really dignify, or are you? You keep talking about New York Times v. Sullivan. What is your position regarding that?
Regarding that with respect
client,
to Mr. Hanshew?
Yes.
I would wholeheartedly submit that he's a journalist. In fact, he regularly meets with Anita Lee from the Sun-Herald. He is sources for information for the Times-Picayune.
Okay.
He absolutely, his information that he develops as a journalist, now he's also a CPA, by the way, and that, I guess, is his day job. His night job is running this blog. But I would absolutely characterize him as a journalist that is entitled to the protections that this court and the Supreme Court has consistently upheld. And if you look at the case law in Canada, it's clear that there is a vast dissimilarity between the standards for proving defamation or libel in Canada and that in the United States. In fact, it's almost a strict liability in Canada. Falsity and damages are presumed.
What do you do with that case that they cite out of Mississippi with the, pardon me for mentioning this, about with the nymphomaniac where they said that was per se and so you didn't have to say, do you know the Mississippi case?
Yes, ma'am.
They cite, how do you distinguish that case?
Well,
because that was, that I think they're sort of arguing that you just have to say these things and they're on their face defamatory.
I would respectfully disagree. I think that the burden still falls upon the plaintiff seeking to enforce a foreign judgment in this country to prove that the statements that Mr. Hanshew made were false, and they simply did not do that. They didn't do it in Nova Scotia, nor did they do it before Judge Girola in federal court. And they had that opportunity, certainly.
So do you believe that case is wrong or just inapplicable for some reason?
No, ma'am. I think it's distinguishable. I think I don't know what the mode of proof was in that case, quite honestly. I don't know if it was a full-blown trial on the merits or if it was decided by way of summary judgment. But this I will say, that the plaintiffs in this case, neither in the Nova Scotia proceeding nor in the federal court in Mississippi, proved that the allegations or the statements that Mr. Hanshew made were ever false. And that was a burden that was cast upon them by not only the Speech Act, but also by Mississippi substantive law, specifically the Fulton case, where they're required to prove false and defamatory statements, publication to a third party, and fault amounting to negligence, and the existence of harm caused by the publication. And so if you read Judge Girola's decision, it's a very well-reasoned decision. And I would submit to the court this, that at the outset, the plaintiffs even concede that because this matter was decided on cross motions for summary judgment without the need for any discovery, without the need for any discovery pleadings or depositions, that in essence, this was a trial by stipulated facts. And for that reason, I would submit to the court that Judge Girola's findings are entitled to greater deference than perhaps it would otherwise be entitled to if it was just a ordinary determination on summary judgment. But be that as it may, Judge Girola found that in this case, the plaintiffs had not proven falsity in the Canadian court, which they were required to do. He also found that the plaintiffs would not have even prevailed under Mississippi law. Now, to some extent, that does require him to probe the plaintiff's proof. And in probing the plaintiff's proof, as Mr. Laird referred, a seven-inch book, Judge Girola did not find that the plaintiffs in this case had proven that any of these generalized statements, Judge Elrod, as you pointed out, if you read the complaint, my head was swimming as I was reading it because I could not discern any particular specifics of statements that they alleged were false and then that they proved were false. They didn't do it. And so when you read Judge Girola's well-reasoned decision, he decided that not only would the plaintiffs have not prevailed under the well-accepted standards set forth in New York Times versus
Sullivan. You'll concede that if there was a default on the complaint, then the allegations in the complaint would be taken as true.
That's correct. But it still requires Judge Girola to make the substantive determination under the Speech Act as to whether or not the plaintiffs claim proved that their claims were false, number one, because they've got to make a prima facie case on a default. They can't just can't hold the petition up and say, well, there it is. And
it's not sworn, for example.
Well, exactly.
Right. You have to come in and prove up your case on the default hearing.
Precisely.
Just like state courts do all over the country every day.
Absolutely. You've got to make a prima facie showing. You can't just submit the petition and say, there we are, and now I want damages. You've got to make a prima facie showing. And they didn't do that in this case. And one other point that I want to make, and then I'll entertain any questions from the panel, that I found particularly offensive about the Nova Scotia court's ruling, and that is the injunctive relief. And while it really wasn't before Judge Girola in the motions for summary judgment, even Judge Girola seized on that. And the court is well aware that the Nova Scotia court entered an injunctive order prohibiting Mr. Hanshew from commenting on any of the plaintiffs in this case and also ordered him to remove from his blog any posts that mentioned the plaintiffs. Now, this court is well aware that injunctions regarding prior restraint are viewed with great disfavor.
Do we have authority to determine that issue right now? Is that teed up to us if
yes,
Judge Girola didn't rule on it?
Yes, ma'am. I would submit that it is because Judge Girola did address it in his ruling. And
but
in essence,
did he overturn the injunction? It's not clear to me.
I'll be quite candid, Your Honor. It's not real precise in whether or not he was ruling that offended the notions of the First Amendment.
But he issued a final judgment in favor of your client.
Yes, ma'am. And so, in essence,
it's wrapped up in there.
I would submit that, yes, implicitly he did address that by granting the summary judgment in favor of Mr. Hanshew.
So do we need to specifically address it in our opinion, or would we just rule on the summary judgment and it falls or stands as with the
I would beg and beseech this court to address that for this simple reason. There is ongoing litigation involving these parties, and it continues. There's lawsuits filed in Orleans Parish. I've even been named as a defendant by one of these parties in a lawsuit. And so I think that the only way that we're ever going to put a stop to all of this frivolous defamation and libel litigation that's entertained in foreign jurisdictions is for this court to uphold Judge Girola's order, ordering Mr. Hanshew to stop publishing about these people and the things that they've done. So, yes, Your Honor, I would submit that does need to be addressed in any decision from this court. And with that, I'll conclude. If the court has any questions for me, thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate your time and attention.
Mr. Hanshew is making arguments that are not before the court. His client is not a journalist. He says here to this court that he is. There's no motion under 12B to contest jurisdiction before Judge Girola at the district court. It was not brought up until the jurisdiction was not even brought up, subject matter or personal jurisdiction, until well into the brief of Mr. Hanshew on the motions for summary judgment and then on this appeal. There's been no fact-finding about jurisdiction. We say under the helicopterist decision that Judge Girola's finding making a decision, go beneath the decision, you can see that the facts show that he found jurisdiction. But my point is that there's no motion contesting jurisdiction. I agree the court can bring it up any time, and that's what we're here for. We're all talking about personal jurisdiction, but that Mr. Hanshew didn't
choose. So you want us to decide the case on the merits, is what you're saying?
Pardon?
You want us to rule on the merits?
Well, I'm just trying to address counsel opposite's argument about his client being a journalist and about.
Is the injunction in force?
No.
Is it because Judge Girola's order? If your client, you believe the injunction is not in force?
Your Honor, that Judge Girola's reference to the injunction is not necessary. Under the Uniform Enforcement of Foreign Judgments Act, my clients enrolled their Canadian judgment in Hancock County Circuit Court. It was limited to relief for money. That was what was litigated at the district court level, cross motions for summary judgment on the monetary relief. My clients have a $400,000+ judgment in the Nova Scotia court. They're trying to execute on Mississippi. They're not trying to enforce any injunctive relief they got in Canada. That's not the issue. Judge Girola did refer to it, but that's not an issue before him.
So it's not an issue before us, the injunction, at all?
It is not. It is not.
Well, is the injunction in place in Canada then?
It is in place in Canada. But that's not the issue here. That's not what we're seeking to accomplish in Mississippi.
But if we determine the Canadian court didn't have jurisdiction, then wouldn't the injunction fall as well?
It would fall in this country, but that's not an issue before the court. We're not asking for injunctive relief. And I don't think it would cross the border into Canada, but it's a moot point in my view, Your Honor, because we're not asking for any injunctive relief. Now, I'd like to address another point that I want to try to correct the record on. In Gamboa, the Northern District Mississippi case, that was strictly a default hearing under Rule 55. That was a case where a female employee alleged certain things about her character, and then she refused to show up after notice. The district court conducted a default hearing, which was exactly like is done in Mississippi state practice and in the federal practice under our Rule 55, both federal and state.
The person had to come in and say they said this, and it's not true.
But they did come in and say it's not true.
Yeah, they had to come in and swear as the proponent to get the default, and that's what's missing in this case. There's no hearing where they proved up and said, they said we're on the verge of bankruptcy, really our 1090s, our financials are sound, and here's, and that's the part that's missing in this case, where the prove-up hearing,
Your Honor,
for the default.
In all due respect, I would very humbly disagree and ask the court to consider the brief at page 20.
When you say you disagree, are you disagreeing that it was not done? You're saying was done, or do you disagree that that's a requirement in Mississippi?
I'm saying it was done and it is a requirement. The court has to inquire in order to award damages about whether the claims are valid claims, and that's what the Canadian court did, just as a Mississippi federal or state court would have done. And it was not a separate hearing. That is, I think, proper.
Even after a default judgment is what you're saying.
Especially after a default judgment. That's what Rule 55 contemplates, in my view. And Gamboa and the other cases we cite from the federal courts hold that on default, the plaintiff has waived arguments, including arguments about falsity. They're taken as truth. And my clients didn't rely on the default procedure. They went forward on sworn testimony and proved falsity.
No, the plaintiff bears the burden on the falsity in the United States. So it's not assumed that there's falsity, that the statements, you have to come in and say they said this and it was false. You still have that burden as the proponent, the plaintiff has that burden, even if the defendant doesn't show up. It's not assumed that they're false just because the complaint says so. This is not even a sworn complaint.
Your Honor, I'm out of time, but
I want you to address this. This is important. Can you explain where we're wrong?
Your Honor, starting at page 20 of our brief, we show what the court found as far as the allegations of falsity. And it talks about the First Amendment statement of claim. The court says the plaintiffs were erroneously identified as being connected with Mr. Broussard. At page 21 of our brief, Trout Point lodged a Jefferson Parish corruption scandal. Materials were submitted to the court, which were testified to by Charles Leary at page 21. At page 22, Trout, this is an allegation, again, before September of 2011. In fact, it's August 30, 2011, at page 22 of a brief. Trout Point Lodge will be bankrupt within a year. And he said that on August 30th. He calls them grifters, grafters. And the court says at page 23, these statements are unfounded.
But those are not actionable defamatory statements. To say someone is going, might be bankrupt before the end of the year is not a defamatory statement. Nor is all of these are reprehensible, these homophobic comments. None of those are actionable defamatory statements as the Nova Scotia court. They just lumped them all in and said that they're all erroneous. And many of those are not actionable defamatory statements.
Your Honor, I submit that under Mississippi law, it's actionable per se. It is defamatory per se to accuse someone of committing a crime of moral turpitude. Those are the holdings in the cases we cite. And I submit it's without dispute that saying somebody perjures himself in a court is in fact.
But that was after the complaint date.
No.
It has to be defamatory statements before the complaint, doesn't it?
He's saying that about both before and after the complaint's filed, Your Honor. There are other litigations he's talking about. And in our brief we set forth, Mr. Hanchu is arguing about ACOA, A-C-O-A. It's a Canadian state agency that gave a grant to my client. And he says they perjured themselves in that state, that Canadian proceeding. That's long before September 1, 2012, or 2011, excuse me. I'd be happy to answer any other questions you might have.
I think we have your argument. Thank you.
Thank you.